possible and for those lovely introductions. Well, it's fitting here that we are talking at the Steelworkers Hall because I think one of the great lacunae of environmentalist thought has been the problem of work and what to do with work. That, for me, Marx tells us that work is an ontological condition, that work is always bundled, always entangled with the rest of nature, that relations of work are always relations of power, that relations of work are always relations of accumulation and contestation. So this is part of a longer conversation, what I will call world ecology with the hyphen. This is not, if you are not familiar with this, the usual environmentalist talk. This is not about saving nature. It is not about how nature is falling into crisis, although it is. This is about how capitalism works, and how we can come to understand the historical limits of capitalism without succumbing either to a class struggle determinism or a resource determinism, that we need to look historically at how capitalism creates the possibilities for renewed and expanded accumulation, and how it may be confronting the limits of those today. So here I'm just going to start with a few of these conventional illustrations of how we know a state shift. That's a rather dry term for something quite terrifying, that is abrupt and irreversible changes in the web of life are ongoing. Note the Neo-Malthusian assumption to this. This is what Earth system scientists are in love with. Malthus dies a long, slow death, unfortunately, way too slow for us. This is also, of course, an era of what's called a mass extinction. In my view, this is much too polite a term. We should instead talk about capitalism as a system of mass extermination, of the extermination of life that is present from the very beginning but increasingly activates forms of value that I would call negative value, that are not only extremely toxic and lethal, but also that capitalism cannot overcome through its own productivist ontology. Now, in the discussion, and I was delighted to hear that you've had Ian Angus here, so you get a sense of the Anthropocene discussion. There are two Anthropocenes, and I'm going to walk through those, but I think in either case, the Anthropocene, the global climate conversations, pose really important, huge questions. Who and what caused this? When and where did this all begin? How did we get here? And who is we anyway? As I tell my students, who is we? They say, the capitalists. Okay, that's right. It's the capitalists who are doing this. It is not anthropogenic. It is a capitalogenic world that we live in. And I think as radicals concerned about planetary crisis and the relations of life, we need to resolutely name the system. We need to stop dancing around this. This is not anthropogenic climate change. It is capitalogenic climate change. So here are the familiar hockey stick representations. I think that these all represent different vectors, and you've all planetary change, urbanization, population, CO2, all this. The folks who draw these don't really know what they mean. They are representations that are absent an explanatory framework. The best that environmentalist thought, even I would suggest the Rift approaches of Bellamy, Vosker and company, give us is society plus nature. Capitalism plus nature equals crisis or catastrophe. This is green arithmetic. So what's the problem with this? Well, as dialecticians, as Marxists, as activists, we can realize that the whole does not add up. So we have two Anthropocenes. One is a geological Anthropocene. This is an argument over stratigraphy. This is an argument over what are going to be the appropriate stratigraphic signals that an archaeologist or an Earth system scientist 2 million years ago from now will be able to detect in the global stratigraphic layers. Well, the great achievements of capitalism here are registered. The atomic explosions, plastics, chicken bones. That's all that we'll come down to in 2 million years. And geological Anthropocene, great. That's an important debate. It's a real contribution to understanding humans in the web of life and all of that. But there's another Anthropocene. It's the popular Anthropocene, and this is a debate over the relations that initiated the drive towards planetary crisis, this state shift, and how do we understand that crisis. This is the conversation that refuses to name the system. Is it the Anthropocene, the age of humans, or is it the Capitalocene, the age of capital? And I think that if we want to have a concept that talks about the drivers of planetary crisis, the drivers that are irreducibly capitalogenic, then we need to challenge the popular Anthropocene. We need to have a concept of the Capitalocene. Why is this? Well, for lots of reasons. First of all, the anthropogenic doesn't describe, it describes an actor that is fundamentally ahistorical. And here is a rather alarming, we find an alarming parallel with Malthusian thought, which has actors without history. The great crime of Malthusian thinking is only in part it's giving primacy to population, but also it's removing these questions of population and nature from history. So capitalogenic gives us a way to think about historical specificity. But this is also a way of arguing against capitalism as an economic and social system. Yes, it is that in certain ways. It is also a system of power. It is also a system of nature. And if we have a theory of capital without a theory of power and nature and how those are mutually constituting, we are going to end up with politics that are going to be fragmented and not up to the challenges of an era of state shift in the planetary system and in the world ecology. So we would argue in world ecology that we need to understand historical change with humans in it, in the modern world at any rate, as a system of capital, power, and nature that is moving beyond green arithmetic. So periodization here matters. It matters if we start the clock in 1800. It matters if we think that capitalism emerges because of coal and steam, or as Naomi Klein says in her otherwise quite useful book, that capitalism had to come about because of coal and colonies. No, I don't think that's the right periodization. I believe that if we are looking at the relations of capital, nature, and power, if we want to understand the origins of what we are calling the Industrial Revolution, which often leads a highly stylized and largely mythical life in our conversations, if we want to understand that turning point of the early 19th century, then we need to look at the relations of capital, power, and nature that forged over three centuries prior. So the first thing I want to say is 1492 is not past, it's not even over. So 1492 is still with us, and this was partly the Columbian Project, you know, the raping and killing and enslaving of the Columbian Project. It was also the emergence of what Max Weber once called the European rationality of world domination, with its profit cost calculus and its view of nature as external, space as flat, time as linear. It was also inventing the God trick. This is one of the earliest surviving modern Portuguese maps, where you can see that the first thing you want to do if you're going to conquer the world is you've got to make a map of it. And the first great thing that every empire did was when they were going about mapping and colonizing and conquering and plundering the rest of the world was they established a geography department. So geography is hugely important. And this is more than map making, but cartography is a huge part of it. All right, so now for the moment, I'm going to pick on the Greens, and in a moment, I'll pick on the Marxists. So first, the Green thought, and this is a crude generalization, and there were many dissenters. There were many counter-tendencies to what I'm describing here, but I think this describes something important about how environmentalist thought since the 1970s has formed. And it's basically asked this question: what does capitalism do to nature? And I think that this allowed a kind of skipping over, a kind of elision, a kind of end run around the question of work. So what happens if we turn it inside out? What happens if we ask, how does capitalism put nature to work? So this is to say that capitalism doesn't work because it does terrible things to nature and the rest of us. It does that. But because it has been successful at mobilizing and appropriating manifold natures, putting natures to work, including human natures, as we'll see, to work for free or low cost. Now, there's an old phrase in Marxist circles of talking about nature as a free gift. Now, that actually was Engels' term, and I'm not going to bag on Engels, but Engels got it wrong. These are free gifts only from a very narrow perspective of how capital looks at the world. But the creation of this idea of the free gift obscures and erases an extraordinary amount of the work of indigenous peoples, of extra-European peoples, of women, etc., that goes on outside of the cash nexus, but is absolutely indispensable to the cash nexus. So we're going to return to this question of unpaid work and unpaid work energy. So at the core of Marxist thought, I think, across the 20th century, and of course we've seen extraordinary and dynamic and important arguments pointing out that commodification depends upon imperialism, depends upon the unpaid work of human and extra-human nature. But there is still a prevailing economism when we talk about capitalism that says commodification is everything. And so we get a kind of autocentric accumulation model that goes like this. Capital moves out and commodifies and capitalizes more and more and more of life. And there's some truth to that. But I want to say that for every movement of capitalization, for every movement of the exploitation of labor power in Marx's sense, we have even greater movements of the appropriation of the unpaid work of human and extra-human natures. The appropriation of the work in Maria Mies's great phrase of women, nature, and colonies. This is an asymmetrical relationship, and that's important. And it's important in value theoretic terms because it tells us that the relations that go on in making a commodity are not the whole of the relations that produce value, that the relations that produce value in a Marxist sense are dependent upon the pedestal of unpaid work. So that means that one of the ways that we could see the history of capitalism is as a history of capitalism, as a sort of an archipelago of capitalization, of the islands of the cash nexus, within oceans of cheap or potentially cheap nature. African slaves, Persian Gulf oil, English coal fields, etc., etc. So this is a more compelling model in which the small red circle is the cash nexus, the circuit of capital, that depends on much larger movements of accumulation by appropriation, that is, the appropriation by extra economic means of unpaid work, humans, and the rest of nature, and the green represents potentially cheap nature. That green slice has become but a sliver today. So we are living in the era of 1492 because we are still living in Pangaea. And in this sense, the Colombian invasion represented something far more than a greatly expanded replay of the plunder and violence of so-called merchant capital or pre-industrial capital. And it represented more than plunder, more than the Orbis spike in Meslin and Lewis's term, the nadir of indigenous population in the New World, but also and ultimately more decisive because this was linked to a new productive revolution, mobilizing the potential work energy of multiple continents. And here you get to see the combination. Here's Pangaea in one corner. You see what we mentioned, Crosby's ecological imperialism. The problem with that is there's no imperialism in it. Well, in order for those flows, those exchanges of sugar, for instance, to the New World and maize and potatoes to Europe, maize and potatoes, by the way, which come to the rescue of European agriculture right around 1700, not coincidentally in the era, at the onset of a great wave of proletarianization that precedes, in the 18th century, that precedes the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century. These are all looping around together. So these don't just happen. They are the exercise of imperial, scientific, and capitalist power in constantly dynamically evolving configurations, organizations, and geography departments that I mentioned in a metaphorical way that are at the core of imperialism are not only about map making, but also about the collecting of biological, botanical, and animal specimens to move around the planet, something that continues, of course, to the neoliberal era in the form of corporate bioprospecting and all of the rest. So what I want to suggest is that capitalism is a way of organizing cheap nature. I mean, cheap nature is an organizing strategy whose central logic is to reduce the value composition of commodities through a system of endless accumulation. And this, I think, gives us a way out of the vampire model of green thought. So even Marxists widely embrace this. This is a neo-Ricardian model, declining returns. A capitalism exhausts, capitalism depletes, and yeah, that goes on. But there's more to that. That doesn't account for capitalism's extraordinary dynamism in co-producing natures by drawing on frontiers outside of the cash nexus. So capitalism's decisive task is to transform work energy in the abstract and turn it into value, turn it into abstract social labor. So this meant that instead of land productivity being the main metric of wealth and power, that was the case in medieval Europe, that there was a shift towards labor productivity. Not all humanly productive work, but labor productivity that went in within that small red sphere that we saw in the earlier charts. So this allowed for a radical and largely unrecognized acceleration in landscape change after 1492 that were the indispensable preconditions for what we know as the Industrial Revolution. And oh, by the way, if we want to think that fossil fuels are central, the English coal revolution doesn't begin in the 18th century. It begins in the 1530s, and we're going to come back to that. But what we also need to do is to move beyond an economism to understand that systems of abstract domination and oppression and race and gender work through a system of accumulation in a non-derivative kind of way. We need to have a theory of how race and gender matter for the endless accumulation of capital in all of this. So when I talk of cheap nature as a strategy, we're looking at three major movements. And in the book, I chart both the long durée, the secular cumulative trends, but also the cyclical movements of long waves of capitalist development. First, there is a cheapening in price, that is, driving down the necessary labor time in the reproduction of what they call the four cheaps. We mentioned that: labor power, food, energy, and raw material. And this does two things. First of all, it emphasizes a point long established in critical agrarian studies, which is that the price of labor power and the price of food are tightly linked. That's important. The other is that it brings into Marx's political economy, again, the forgotten category of constant capital. That is circulating capital. The raw materials and other inputs used up in a production cycle, which form a vital and strategic vector of the tendentially rising value composition of capital. So that's one moment of it. We also have to cheapen in a broadly cultural sense, in a Gramscian sense, an ethico-political sense, to degrade, to render various forms of work less worthwhile or dignified while still achieving some kind of social compact. And then finally, cheapening nature, extra human natures, as external and enabling the double cheapening of the lives and work of plants, ecosystems, non-human animals, etc., recognizing that human work and human activity is always in that category. So again, here we have the tripartite division of labor under capitalism. So history matters. Okay, why does history matter? Well, I think it matters because to start the clock in 1800 says the problem is coal. I think to start the clock in 1492 says that the problems of capitalism are the emergent processes of rationality and domination and capitalist exploitation and the development of the productivist forces in a very specific way that have largely escaped the attention of Marxists, because Marxists, like many in the 20th century, have been captivated by the forces, notion of the forces of production as mechanical. And I think that misses the active role of how states and science work together to produce forms of nature that are legible to capital, that can be taken up by capital, but which capital is not responsible for reproducing. So this leads me to beyond green arithmetic. And one of the passages from Marx that strikes me most powerfully is that opening page of the discussion of the labor process. And he talks about a threefold transformation: the relations of work between humans, the relations of humans and the rest of nature, or external nature, both Marxist terms, and earlier in Capital, of the totality of man and man and man and nature as simultaneous, asymmetrical, interchangeable. So in this sense, what we need to be doing is to understand that the process of work and accumulation fundamentally depends on processes that cannot be accounted for in terms of capital accumulation itself, and that we have to look at systems of power, at territorial power, and at culture and science as part of capitalism's extraordinary capacity to reinvent itself. So this means when we look at the rise of capitalism, and we can go in the question and answer if you want in my whole account of the transition, I'm happy to unpack that. I'm finishing a book right now, but I'm not going to give you my big theory on how and why capitalism emerged. I'm simply going to point to the crucial biophysical and work elements of this process. So I would say that the first step is to understand that the accumulation of capital and the endless transformation of the earth in a historically unprecedented way go together, that we need to see two moments in one process. And indeed, I think that the endless accumulation of capital is hard to see, but that the endless transformation of the earth, which we see in the 16th century, is a revolutionary moment in human history. Indeed, what I am putting together is a story of environmental transformations in the era of Columbus and the two centuries after that are as great, as fast, globally encompassing as anything humanity had seen since the dawn of agriculture. And that this marked not only the conquest of the Americas, but a revolution in putting nature to work, in putting Pangaea to work, simultaneously with expelling most human beings from the category of society. So, this allows us to see that there was this peculiar kind of cheap nature strategy that flows from seeing labor productivity in a value sense, in a surplus value sense, as central. So we see an extraordinary rupture in environment making between feudalism and capitalism. There is an order of magnitude shift in the scale, the scope, and the speed of capitalist development between the 15th and 18th centuries relative to the High Middle Ages. Indeed, here's one of my favorite factoids my research on this, that in medieval Picardy, northeastern France, it took 2 centuries to clear 12,000 hectares of forest. 4 centuries later, at the height of the sugar boom in northeastern Brazil and Bahia, it took 1 year to clear 12,000 hectares. This gives you a feel for the extraordinary shift. Of course, one moment doesn't tell a whole story, but there are dozens and dozens of such moments. So what we want, the mistake is to see European expansion as precisely that, as a colonial movement. And it was that, but the invention of Europe and the invention of the Americas go together, and the conquest of the Americas cannot be reduced to commodity production and exchange. It also has to be linked to new geographical and territorial state-led processes and movements of especially the botanical and geographical sciences to appropriate the unpaid work of humans and the rest of nature. So in this, capitalism throws up environment-making complexes of capital, science, and empire in successive eras. Now this also means bringing culture into the equation in a way that reveals them as material forces. Remember, Marx says, even ideas when grasped by the masses become material forces. Well, so too for the bourgeoisie in its period of revolutionary ascendance, that it grasped new cultural forms as a means of advancing the conditions for capital accumulation. And in this, I would say nature and society, the terms as we understand them, drip with blood and dirt every bit as much as enclosure and colonial conquest. Indeed, these two words, nature and society, assume their familiar meanings in this term, in this era, between 1550 and 1650. So what's happening in this era? Well, first of all, the defeat of Kett's rebellion, the high tide of agrarian resistance to the capitalist transformation of the countryside, 1549. The onset of England's coal revolution, 1530. The rapid expulsion of the agricultural working population, the growth of the non-agricultural and urban population in this period, and oh yes, imperialism. So Henry VIII intensifies the English colonial subordination of Ireland, beginning roughly in 1541, and this is very much framed culturally through a discourse and a practice, the actual practice of colonialism as well, based on civility and savagery, nature and society. And so the Earl of Northampton tells colonial administrators to draw the wild Irish that are in the woods and to assemble them into English-style towns. This was a move that had been prefigured by the Spaniards in the Canaries and would be repeated by the Spaniards again in colonial Peru to resettle the indigenous populations into European, Spanish-style, in the case of the Andes, agro-towns. The Dutch did this in Southeast Asia. This is, of course, is a long history that went into the Vietnam War with strategic hamlets. So this was also a case of the English viewed the Irish as not part of society. They were part of nature. The Castilians called indigenous Peruvians naturales, a term that has many meanings in 16th century Spanish, but was clearly used to designate indigenous peoples as part of nature, as savages. And also a redefinition of whose work matters. By 1700, Federici tells us the definition of women as non-workers was nearly completed. So this was part of a larger cultural transformation of the development of real abstractions, nature, society, man, woman, black, white, the West, and the rest, as a pivotal strategy for reorganizing and revaluing work, constituting new class relations that in which The position of valorized work, of wage labor, found a much larger pedestal in the unpaid work of women, nature, and colonies. This is just my very crude picture of the famous prices-wages gap that emerges in the 16th and 17th centuries around what's called the price revolution. So the uptick of economic activity plus first European and then American gold and silver leads to a revolution in prices. Wages don't increase as much, but no surprise, women's wages fall even faster. So that's quite crucial to this process. It's also crucial to understanding that the history of enclosures is profoundly gendered and that women's labor gets expelled from agriculture much faster than men's labor. So this is about a process not only of expelling peasants and indigenous peoples and others from the land, but of expelling them from humanity, of expelling them from society. And so in this, the majority of humans within capitalist power become part of nature and they're treated accordingly. They're treated as a prop to advance labor productivity within the zone of commodification. So in this sense, strategies of appropriation of law, property, sovereignty, cartography, surveying, much more, enabled racialized and gendered surpluses to be channeled into the circuit of capital. So this has to be part of the story of the political economy of the history of capitalism, as well as everything else. This is also a story of human sacrifice in a very modern sense. So when Orlando Patterson talks about modern slavery as social death, that is, that slaves had no rights in the societies in which they lived, they were not part of society, that was also part of a racialized movement of creating surplus profits. And so too with early modern capitalism's complex reinventions of gender. And Esther King uses this language, and I think that it's more of human sacrifice, that it literally dispossessed women of culture and treated the domain of their activity as natural, the better to be treated as cheaply. This is central to the story, but it's not merely a metaphor. Federici, of course, famously tells the story of the terror of the witch hunts and witch trials, but also, of course, in the case of slavery. You have 240,000 Africans shipped to northeastern Brazil at the height of the sugar boom, with just 60,000 at the end of the story. That gives you a sense of the horrific mortality that went on. 2.2 million slave departures from Africa, just 300,000 African slaves in the Americas by 1700. So this is part of the profound violence of accumulation that can't be reduced to questions of superstructure or excise from the question of the politics of value and how the political economy of capital works. So we have in this process this nature society, this Cartesian binary. So for Descartes, it was not only mind and body, but nature and society. And this did three things if we understand the Cartesian revolution as a broader historical phenomenon. First, it privileged substances over relations. So this goes on in modern environmentalist thought. A lot of concerns of peak oil would be a good example of where Cartesian thinking leaves us. It privileges either or over both and over dialectical thinking. And it favors, of course, the purpose of control over nature by applied science. Or, as Descartes said, we must make ourselves the masters and possessors of nature. If that sounds like the slave owner's motto, it is. And this was part of this greater movement to make time and space and nature convenient and legible and rational and recognizable for capital accumulation. So, as Bikram Gill points out, the Cartesian dualism is also a Cartesian logic after the brutal conquer of Mexico. It is not something just floating out there in the ether. This Cartesian logic is a real dynamic of violence in the real world. So, okay, what about the nature of the trees and the bees and the soils and all that? First of all, we have to recognize that the rise of capitalism was a frontier movement in at least, well, I say three, but now I give you four in this list. So, in at least four big ways. The creation of a global Atlantic and global Baltic, and this is also the emergence of Europe as a meaningful historical category. Enclosures, both de facto and de jure, not only in northwestern Europe, but also in the colonies, driving the combined and uneven development of agricultural revolutions. I think it's a mistake to see agricultural revolutions as confined to the maritime low countries in England, that indeed you see similar, de facto similar processes going on in the sugar complexes of early modern capitalism. You see a radical extension and expansion of monetary credit relations on an order of magnitude, that the capital of the greatest banking families of the 16th century was 10 to 20 times greater than that of, say, the Medici's, the greatest banking family of the 12th and 13th centuries. And finally, you see, as we've noted, the violent politico-cultural definition of indigenous peoples, Africans, and women as nature. And the creation of the extra-European world as a warehouse of potentially pristine nature. So in this sense, capitalism does not have a frontier. It is a frontier process. No frontiers, no process, no capitalism. And so here, I'm just going to very quickly walk us through a quick view of this process to just give you a sense of how dynamic this was. In all the basic commodity sectors of early modern Europe, you have this profound geographical restlessness. At each point along these movements, you see the recomposition of labor relations, of technology, of finance relations, of the relations of putting natures to work, of putting soils to work, of putting forests to work, of organizing the relations between subsistence and commodity activity. And this and for every big movement in the Americas around sugar, which was the greatest, it was the mass commodity of its time. It was the auto industry of the 20th century. Every time the sugar frontier moved, the slaving frontier moved. And I'm going to return to this because one of the things that environmental studies has done very well is to show us the consequences of capitalist violence on environments and peoples and regions. We need to put work in there. We need to put the world division of labor at work on this. Now, I give you this chart not so you can memorize these times and places, but because this shows something that had never before happened in human history, where you had a dynamic commodity sector in sugar move in roughly half-century cycles across the Atlantic. Never before in planetary history had overseas empires been created and sustained, and never before had they moved so fast. I mean, this was an era that Fernand Braudel likens as the biological ancien regime. Everything moves slowly. Well, not in sugar, and not in the hothouses of capitalist development. So these islands of capitalist development, every time the sugar frontier moved, they had to find a new place in Africa to draw slaves out of, because they were exhausting these zones just as they were exhausting the soils and the forests. So when Marx says that capitalism robs the life of the worker and just as the greedy farmer robs the soil, he's not making just a mere parallel. He's saying that these are constitutive, and we see this in the history of capitalism. And we also need to deal with the question of population. And so few, I think here the left has not done a good job in talking about capitalism's special laws of population. I'm deeply inspired by the work of Wally Seacombe, among others, in putting the question of the reproduction of labor power at the center of the history of capitalism. But we also need to see that what we're looking at in the early modern era is a system where commerce, where people follow commerce. Always before, you have movements of settlers, and then commerce follows. But now, commodities, the movement of commodities is now in the vanguard. And that gives us a very different logic of history, and it completely, I think, invalidates the sense that, population pressure in Europe leads to all of these environmental changes. That's absolutely false and empirically untenable. Here I'm just going to throw in a few charts because this is what I call the social death surplus profit. This is the relative to capitalist GDP, the GDP growth of Europe and the extra-European colonies in this period. This is the chart of the slave trade, and it gives us a sense of just how profound the violence and exterminism at the heart of capitalism from the very beginning really is. And so, from here, we can look at a few key episodes of landscape transformation. One of them, as we know from the work of English agricultural and Dutch agricultural historians, is the extraordinary agricultural revolution of the Maritime Low Countries in England. You know, by about 1600, 1700, these are essentially treeless landscapes. They're extraordinarily effective at producing more and more food with less and less people. You have rapidly, this is a chart for England, you have skyrocketing yields in the period 1550 to 1650, 1700, somewhere in there, and then then you see a market stagnation. You have a revival of productivity only because sheep were eating men at this time and much wheat was taken out of cultivation. You have the number of, we need a multi-species demography by well. We need to keep account of the numbers of animals. We're at 60 billion, as Tony Weiss reminds us today. We might go to 120 billion, and that's going to be an absolute colossal disaster. But this is an era when sheep went from about 14 odd to about 19 odd million in the space of 50 years. In England, this was a sign of this was linked up with the exhaustion of the English agricultural revolution. Per capita food consumption in England dropped between 1750 and 1800. So these are all important. But it's not all agronomy and class struggle. It's also the surveying revolution. Indeed, England does invent maps as we know them. And it's a terrible picture, but you get the sense everywhere in England was surveyed by the end of the 17th or the early 18th century. Here is one of the forgotten moments that you can see the devastated landscapes here that come from before there was Potosi, there was the mining and metallurgical revolution of Central Europe. This was where the silver, iron, copper, and lead that was ultimately the basis for what followed was first brought out, that this was also linked to a fundamental reorganization of corporate, of what it meant to have a business, that before this era of the late 15th century in Central Europe, merchants had many businesses. After that, they began to have a business. There were the Fuggers and the Welsers and the Genoese Centurione and all the rest. So Agricola in this period, who was a great booster of mining, and says, oh, the woods and the groves are cut down, and you know, we have an endless need for all of this, and the waters are poisoned. And then about a page or so later, he says, it doesn't matter because it's so profitable. We can bring all these things in. This is a very sort of modern picture of the substitutability of nature, and who cares, growth will continue, and all things will resolve themselves. We have the first signs of the modern sugar slave nexus in Madeira and then Sao Tome and the Atlantic Islands, followed very quickly by the rise of northeastern Brazil. This leads to the first great wave of clearance in Brazil's Atlantic rainforest. Remember this example of 12,000 hectares of forest cleared in a single year. The interesting thing about that is it's not alone. The same movement of forest clearance producing the great industrial raw materials for northwestern Europe was happening in Poland in the Vistula Basin. Potash for bleaching, and naval stores and timber for the great fleets that sailed the world. So shipbuilding was a basic industry and was subject to the same processes of rationalization and the movement towards relative surplus value that we associate with large-scale industry after 1800. This was also, of course, the slaving frontier. The Dutch move in to control the spice trade and to control the production of spices as well, enabled not least through extermination and forms of ethnic cleansing. Here we have pictures of Potosi, the great Silver Mountain, which is, again, not just a story of found wealth, but a story of audacious and extraordinary colonial restructuring. In the 1550s and 60s, Philip II, trying to wage a war of global domination on two fronts, goes broke. Potosi no longer coughs up its easy silver. So by 1569, the Spanish Empire sets in motion this audacious strategy of resettling 1.5 million people, that is equivalent to the population of Portugal at the time, into reducciones, the Spanish-style towns, instituting a forced wage work system that was not only the wage workers, but also they traveled with their families and with thousands, tens of thousands of llamas. There was massive deforestation, indeed, the rising cost of production, so you had workers scouring the Andes for anything that could be used to fuel the mercury amalgamation system. And so much was the infrastructure of colonial Peru a lethal system that Frezier, the French traveler, says, oh, well, you know, you're better now. You know the roads in Peru better by the skeletons of the llamas than by the tracks of the feet. But this was increasingly effective. Silver output skyrockets, and you have, of course, the long-run murderous demographic decline of the indigenous populations. You have the clearing of wetlands across Europe. You have the exhaustion of forests, which lead to the global recentering of Spanish shipbuilding, especially in the Caribbean world by 1700. You have the extension of shipbuilding and naval stores, timber sectors in North America. Of course, this is the country that gave us Harold Innes, so there's an Innesian story there without all the commodity fetishism that goes with it. This is also a story of the Baltic as a kind of America on Europe's doorstep. That the Baltic, of course, is not part of Europe until very late in the game. Some would wonder if it's even part of Europe today. And again, the story of agricultural revolutions cannot be contained within one region. That the Dutch agricultural revolution propels a set of agrarian and industrial transformations that depend vitally on a semi-colonial relationship to Poland as their breadbasket. And this, of course, Poland gets exhausted and has to be supplanted by Britain. Well, Britain then exhausts itself after becoming the granary of Europe for about 50 or 60 years, stops exporting grain entirely, and begins to import them, especially import grain, especially from Ireland, setting the stage, of course, for the murderous famines of the 19th century. And you see this terrific churning commodity, colonial, territorial, innovative dynamism and from one place to the other, from Ireland to Barbados to the fur trapping frontiers, the silver production after Potosí essentially taps out its richest veins. They go to Mexico and they wreak havoc in Mexico. And of course, we do get the English coal revolution. This is, again, gives us a sense of the coal revolution relative to the economic growth, which is only a measure of a money economy. And the figures that we have for early modern GDP are, in any case, quite limited. So we have this process, this churning, destructive, but also profoundly dynamic and creative and productive dynamic that goes on across this period, in which the expansion of the proletariat, in which the expansion of the money economy, in which the expansion of formal relations of surplus value production are at every step dependent on much larger appropriations of the unpaid work and energy of this Pangaea. But let's not leave it there. So every Marxist wants to say then, well, you know, don't we have this extraordinary productivity, labor productivity advance after 1800? This is the story of coal and steam and all of that. Well, yes, we do, but it wasn't the first such great labor productivity revolution. And here I'm just going to walk through give you a few snippets here. The printing press, sugar mills, iron making, shipbuilding, which moves to standardized parts, replacing skilled labor with mechanized sawmills by the end of the 16th century. You have these new forms of technical advance that appear very early. There's a long list that I provide elsewhere. You can look at my capitalist scene essays to give you a sense of this. But even if we want to talk about mechanization, this was present from the 16th and 17th century. The idea of merchant capitalism is much too narrow to capture the productivist dynamism of this period. And when we say productivist dynamism, we imply the sucking in of the work of humans and the rest of nature into the vortex of accumulation on an unprecedented scale. The reason why early capitalism was so dynamic in its labor productivity was because it was, in a powerful sense, this extraordinary apparatus of mapping and controlling and identifying the possibilities for putting natures of all sorts to work. So what I want to do is to emphasize that the development of capitalism's productive forces are not merely about mechanization, but also about new ontologies, new epistemologies, new scientific regimes. And you see this clustered in a way that we really see, that really sets the stage for subsequent eras of cultural and intellectual transformation, new world of quantifiable abstractions, new cartographies, new schools of painting and music, philosophies of mind and body, mathematization, etc., was hugely important. But also, of course, the rise of world money in its modern sense. And this takes shape, this finally crystallizes in the early 17th century. Where does it crystallize? It crystallizes at the headquarters, the switchboard of organizing capitalism's planetary nature in the early 17th century in Amsterdam. In around the Amsterdam Bourse, the Dutch East India Company, the Amsterdam Exchange Bank, all in the early 17th century. So that by the 1660s, you have 550 different commodities. So here we see that world power, world money, world nature are all forming a self-organizing dynamic whole by this point, by the early 17th century. So this is a way of moving from technology to technics, to including the problems of technology, but to understand that technologies develop, epoch-making technologies develop with a particular relationship to the rest of nature. And the great epoch-making technologies of the modern world have all been frontier technologies. They have been the shipbuilding and cartographic revolution of early modern Europe. The the steam engine is a frontier technology. It develops at the pit head of mines. Its frontier is a subterranean frontier. The internal combustion engine, we can say the same. These are all frontier technologies. Along with this, we see the emergence of new ways of mapping the world that we hinted at. This is the first act of every great empire, establish a geography department. This was a TO map. You can't conquer the world with a TO map. This was the kind of map that worked for the Crusades. You could say Asia is at the top because Asia was regarded by Europeans as the center of the world. This is a map you can go and conquer the world with. It's distorted in so many fundamental ways. It distorts the size of southern continents and all this, but you can navigate with this. Mercator, of course, is Latin for merchant. Mercator was not only a merchant, but also an industrial capitalist. He made engraved globes and sold them. So there is a very tight logic, tight dynamic here. All right, so now we're going to move from the rise of capitalism to its possible demise. And I don't have a crystal ball. I'm not saying in 2031 everything's coming to an end and we'll have a new era. We can hope sooner than that, but reality is very thorny. I want to identify two great problems. I think that, practically speaking, what we are seeing over the past 40 years is the end of the cheap nature strategy. That is, the end of the strategy that has used frontiers and created frontier spaces to reset the four cheaps of cheap labor, power, food, energy, and raw materials, to expand the material volume and to expand the material volume, say, of food, while using less average labor time to produce them. And we can go through the list for this. I think that tendentially we are seeing the end of this. However, of course, in the 1970s, this was not the case, and I'm going to walk through that in about 2 seconds. The other is that I think we're seeing the rise of negative value. I think that, and by that I mean the emergence of forms of nature, including human social movements, that cannot be resolved through the old productivist fixes. So this includes centrally climate change, new diseases, super weeds and super bugs in agriculture, but also I think the new ontological politics of food sovereignty, climate justice, degrowth, etc. I don't want to romanticize those movements, but I think that there's something important there. What we saw in the restoration of cheap nature, of course, was the restoration of these four cheaps: a capitalist counteroffensive in North and South to enact wage repression, the stabilization of oil prices and energy prices for 20 years after 1983, not coincidentally when rates of profit for the then G7 countries revived right in 1983. The price of food fell by 39% in the late 70s and early 80s for metals by half. So this was quite extraordinary. But it was its effects were relatively anemic for capital accumulation. This did not produce a new golden age. And this will be familiar, I think, to many of you in the audience, but I simply want to put the question of cheap labor at the center of how we think about cheap nature. That this was a vicious and dynamic process of class struggle that from which issued wage repression, the emergence of the global factory, but not just the global factory. The global factory emerged only through the great global enclosure of worldwide agrarian dispossession. We saw after 1989 in Richard Friedman's words of the great doubling, I think that's a bit of an exaggeration, but the great doubling of the world workforce. What are we seeing today? We're seeing the signs of a great contraction, rising dependency ratios, especially in the global north, but also in China, sharply declining labor market growth. The business press is all a Twitter, the end of cheap labor, and all that. That may be exaggerated, but there is a kernel of rationality to that that we need to pay attention to on the left. We also need to see that this great doubling was deeply feminized, that this was a process of adding the work of adding paid work on top of the unpaid work on an unprecedented scale. So this was the unprecedented global expansion of Arlie Hochschild's second shift. So the end of cheap nature, who knows? Will cheap nature be restored? I don't think so, but we can argue about that. First of all, oil, this is not a peak oil argument, that the cost of bringing new oil into production, of a new barrel of oil into production, has increased 5 to 10-fold, I would say closer to 10-fold over the past 10 to 15 years relative to the past 20 years. The price of energy is, for now, stabilized by very low credit costs. So that's a dynamic that we'll have to pay attention to. And people say, well, there's plenty of cheap labor in the world. Yes and no. There are only a few industrial heartlands in China. We know real wages have been outpacing inflation for a while. Unit labor costs are rising. Labor rest is rising. I don't want to make too much of that, but neither, I think, should we make too little. And the shift from, say, Chinese wages being at 2.5-3 cents on the American dollar to 5 or 6 cents on the American dollar is a massive shift. The runaway factories are running, but have fewer places to run. Metal production remains sluggish. Yes, the prices have come off their commodity boom highs, but not returned to their pre-commodity boom lows, and that's an issue. And cheap food, well, we were talking about this over dinner, but I think cheap food is done. I think we're going to see a lot of niche marketing, organic food marketing, and what we've seen with cheap food is really a triple process here going on. First of all, challenged increasingly by food justice and food sovereignty movements, but which for all their problems demonstrate a profound shift, a cultural shift in our relationship to food, and not just in the global north, but across the world. We see the continuing failure of the biotech revolution. Climate change is already implicated in suppressing the cereal agricultural productivity worldwide. And we have to remember, everybody wants to talk about fossil capitalism now. Well, we should also talk about cereal capitalism, which is even more fundamental. The capitalism is fundamentally linked to cereal agriculture in, frankly, weird ways that we can talk about. But the limits of its productivity are, if anything, more important and more directly politically significant than the issues of fossil capital, though they both go together. And I think, so as we wrap up, what's been hidden from view by taking this green arithmetic approach? Nature, society. I think it hides a lot. And I think it hides how life and work has been devalued and revalued, and how the system of accumulation works not simply through a relation of capital and labor power, but of capital and unpaid work, and that those are mutually constituting dynamics. And so, if we start the clock in 1784, we have a very technocentric view of our political tasks. If we begin with the English and Dutch agricultural revolutions, with Columbus, with the emergence of the European rationality of world domination, we have, I think, a very different picture. And so I think to locate the origins of the modern world with the steam engine and the coal pit is to prioritize shutting down those. But to locate the origins of the modern world in the centuries after 1450 is to privilege the attack and the critique and the effort to transcend these logics, these deep ontological, epistemological, and cultural logics of how we value life and reproduction and all the rest that make for a good life for buen vivir. That it means putting work at the center and transcending the peculiarly and devastatingly alienating relations of work under capitalism, and not just of the wage worker, but of all workers. So this is something that many of us have become familiar with over the past couple of decades. So Marx reminding us, oh, labor's not the source of all wealth. But this last part often gets lopped off. That last part, that labor itself is only the manifestation of a force of nature, human labor power. Marx uses this phrase in regard to labor frequently. That in the Grundrisse he talks about labor as a specifically harnessed natural force. And I think that gives us a way out of this red versus green fundamentalism that I think have attributed what Marx calls, in the Critique of the Goethe Program, supernatural powers to one or the other side of the nature-society binary. I think that there's a lot of a particular kind of theology that goes along with this labor fundamentalism, nature fundamentalism. And it can come in very subtle ways. Here I'm making it very crude, and it's rarely that crude. But I think that it speaks to this huge issue that we've seen in the struggle at Standing Rock, but we see all over the place, especially in extractive economies like Canada, or where I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, this jobs versus environment problem. And so I think Marx gives us a way to cut through the mystifications of this. I mean, Marx gives us a way to see that work is always mobilized in and through the web of life, that it is not just that work has an impact on the web of life, but that this is work is not only a producer of environmental changes, but a product of them. And so when we utter this phrase, labor and nature, we should be clear then that we are speaking of a diverse dialectical unity of labor and nature, nature and labor. This is what they call a double internality. And so these three moments are not separate. They are internalized in the other. So I think there are a lot of implications, and I'm just going to hit on a few. But one of them is emancipatory politics has to stop drawing lines around whose work and whose lives matter and whose does not. That the specification of capitalism's contradictions flows through this unity and diversity. That we should say no politics of work without nature, no politics of nature without work. And then I think a historical and dialectical rethinking can help us see whose lives and whose work is strategically located within capitalism's world ecological contradictions. I think that is something that Marxism has been very good at, although Marxists have often been wrong about it too, is to understand where the system is weak, where are the contradictions. And if we are only looking at the relations between humans, we are going to miss something fundamental in formulating a strategic vision. And to say that the question of the politics of life and work can no longer be enclosed within society in the uppercase. That, in Thomas Munzer's words, the creatures too must become free. Thank you.